Mitch is a chain-smoking, tough-as-nails investigative journalist for the New York City newspaper, The Daily Bugle. Lois Lane is an award-winning, tough-as-nails reporter for the Metropolis newspaper, The Daily Planet. Chris Hoffman is not. He's the guy we got on a podcast. It's time for the Lane Ulrich Report with extra special correspondent, Chris Hoffman.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to today's episode of the Lane Ulrich Report. I'm Chris Hoffman. Today, we have the pleasure of talking with Tony Moy, who is a mixed media artist who's based out of downtown Chicago. He has a focus on watercolor and gouache, fun word to say. Tony has made a name for himself in the art world, publishing his works in art books from The X-Files, Dungeons & Dragons, Memory Collectors, a comic called Mainstream from Zenoscope. He's also had published works with IDW, Dark Horse, and many more. We'd just be sitting here listing these forever if we listed all of them. Along with being an accomplished artist, Tony has over a decade of teaching experience, having taught illustration and design at the School of the Art Institute. I need to say that carefully because that's the name. His inspiration comes from a unique blend of traditional and classic watercolorists, combined with the modern influences of pop culture comics, anime, and fantasy. And Tony's latest work, which is hosted on Webtoon.com, is the comic The 442nd, The Lost Battalion, which follows the Japanese-American 442nd Regiment as they fight through Europe during World War II, while Japanese-American families remained unjustly incarcerated in the U.S. internment camps. And so listen in as we dive into Tony's creative process, his inspirations, and learn more about the powerful story behind his latest project. So, Tony, thank you so much for being here.
Absolutely. Good to be here.
Awesome. Thanks. So let's jump right into your latest project here. I want to talk to you about all of that stuff. And before we started recording, I told you all of the things, hoping we can get this all into 45 minutes or an hour. But so we've actually been Facebook friends for almost 10 years, yeah. Which is amazing.
It's impressive. If it's not on Facebook, it's not real. So,
right. And first thing that one of the things that I was really excited about is recently we were both at the Emerald City Comic Con in Seattle, Washington.
Yes, one of my favorite shows.
Great Comic Con, so much fun, and finally got a chance to meet you in person, which I was really excited about. And you did a panel about the 442nd Regiment that is on YouTube. People can watch that. And so will you tell people about the project first, and then we'll talk a little bit more about it.
Yeah, so the 442nd, the Lost Battalion, is my current comic project. It's a historical comic, trying to keep it as heavily influenced by the actual history as I can. Obviously, you know, so you got to be a little creative to make the story flow. My goal with it is to tell the story of the Japanese Americans who actually fought for this country during World War II in Europe, and how they became the most decorated group of soldiers in U.S. history. There are 14,000 Japanese Americans that fought over just about 2 years, and those 14,000 earned over 18,000 medals by the end of the war. And many of them were fighting with their families behind barbed wire in the internment camps, which I think is just an amazing story. And to kind of add a little bit onto that, they were already in, many of them were already in the internment camps for over a year. So you have the sort of the experience and the memories of seeing what the internment camp has done to your family, what your family has lost and sacrificed. And then the government comes back to them and says, hey, we're now going to allow you to fight for the country that just did this to your family, right? And many of them still said yes. There were some dissenters, but many of them said, yeah, let me fight for what my country is supposed to stand for. And then they go off and become the best. I think that story was just, history was just simply more inspiring and amazing than anything you can come up with. Sometimes, and I think this is one of those stories.
Right. and one of those stories that's important to be told because maybe it gets missed sometimes or not as much of a focus in history books, depending on what's happening there. This was in my high school experience, the internment of the Japanese was not heavily highlighted. Yeah. It was not spent a lot of time on it. It felt like more, if my memory serves me, it felt like it was a side note.
Yeah, for me as well. Like, I don't think I knew of the internment camps until college or after college, where I stumbled across it by, you know, talking to friends who were Japanese that happened to know a little bit about it or something. And I was like, whoa, wait, this is a part of our history I was not aware of. And I remember trying to be a little more cognizant at that point about, you know, the forgotten or hidden history that sometimes been pushed aside. And I always kind of, since learning about the internment camps, kind of always considered myself a, you know, historically literate, I guess. I'm not an expert, but, you know, literate. I know a little bit about what happens and, you know, read Zinn and some of those other historical books, nonfictions, and things like that, but when it came to the story about the 442nd, I knew nothing. 2 years ago, I stumbled upon them, and I was just simply shocked that I had not even heard an iota of their story. I actually stumbled across it from a documentary, and I thought the documentary was wrong. I was like, "Yeah, they're over exaggerating. Maybe if you look at it in a certain way, in a certain, like, okay, it's kind of crazy that they fought," but like, I did not believe it at all until I did my research, and I, you know, one story led to another, and rabbit hole just got getting deeper and deeper.
That's crazy, and it's sort of like that. Recent pop culture, that TV show, the Watchmen TV show.
Yes, exactly.
And about the bombings in Oklahoma. Yeah, and it's those things that are, to me, they seem important, right? Like, it paints the whole picture. If you're just painting the happy side of something, you're not really catching it. I don't think to me, I feel like it should make you more appreciative of the country in a way of trying to not let that happen again, those types of things happen again, right? Instead of pretending that they weren't there.
Yeah. I think you've kind of hit it on the head. And like, one of the purposes of this is not to kind of make us lament and like feel bad about that part of our history. But I just think that, you know, that the story is inspiring in many ways to fight for an ideal, no matter what the odds, right, is what these men were doing. And within the 442nd, right, the 442nd was had white officers and Japanese American soldiers, is basically how it started off for most of it. And within the 442nd, there was an immense amount of respect. Right, the white officers, and to hear about the Japanese Americans write back in some of their letters and my research about what they thought of their white officers, there was no animosity, and vice versa. Many of the white officers were like, "Let me be a part of this 442nd because I actually do respect them, and you know, want to fight for them." And having those white officers say, "No, you're not sending my boys on this suicide mission," right? And they would literally do that. So within the 442nd, it was a place that didn't have segregation, right? Even though it was kind of created that way. And those stories, and I think, you know, are something to aspire to, if not, hopefully, be inspired by.
Right. No. Yeah. So you mentioned the research that you were doing. How did you, that seems like a daunting task to gather all of that information together, but also quite rewarding. Yeah. And you talked about it a little bit in your panel. Can you talk about like the research that you did and the people that you met during the research that helped you out?
It was tough at first because, you know, we're coming out of the pandemic. So it was 2021, I think. 2021. And it started off with just me in a cave, right? And just the internet was an amazing resource to kind of start off with. And did what I could with that. And I was just like, I know that I have to leave room for knowing that I don't know everything about it. Like, I'm not a World War II scholar. I'm not a research scientist that has all the access to everything. I have to kind of rely on what's on the internet. And so I just kind of, that's one of the reasons why I also decided to do it at first on as a webcomic, keep it digital, right? So that I can make changes to it if need be. And so I just put it out there. I started, as I travel around to a lot of shows, I started contacting if the area had some Japanese American museums or cultural centers or things like that, especially on the West Coast. I would contact them and be like, hey, I'm doing this thing. I know it seems a little weird, but you know, if you can meet up with me and in Seattle, I met up with Japanese American Cultural Museum, and they were the first ones that kind of helped me out with some firsthand research, right? They had a trunk that was donated to them from an actual World War II Japanese American veteran. They opened it up with me, and they allowed me to go through some to see and hold some of the medals that were actually in there, as well as some of the stories that they had about the internment camps. From there, word got around a little bit. Just putting it out there, the 100th veterans organization out of Hawaii. A lot of Hawaiian Japanese Americans fought in the 442nd as well. They kind of randomly reached out to me, and they also provided some information about like, oh, here's some additional information, or if I ask for some research about where exactly the battalions were at certain parts of the war, they would have that information much better than I would. And then finally, the Japanese American Veterans Association reached out, and that was Michael Yaguchi that was part of the panel. And he was an immense help as well. He was involved in a lot of the firsthand research and looking through a lot of the historical documents that were left over by the 442nd. So he was extremely knowledgeable to the point where he could identify, if I had incorrect information, he can identify where that information and trace it back, and here's why that information started. If you look online, the 442nd is also known as a Purple Heart Battalion. They receive so many Purple Hearts. And there's a range between 4,000 and 9,000 Purple Hearts. On one article, you'll see it's 9,000. Another article, you see it's 4,000. Wikipedia, you know, will be 9,000 or something like that, I think. And he was like, yeah, the actual number is the 4,000. The other one is a trace of overestimations. And if you include these types of medals and these other things, and it was really cool to have that in my back pocket, to have him kind of help out. The last part of it, which was something that I wasn't, that second major part of the research, which I wasn't quite prepared for at first, which you think being an artist I would, was the visual research, right? It was one thing to be the historical research. I'm like, okay, doing all this researching. And then I did not realize the amount of historical visual research I would have to do, like not just the guns and the bullets, but ammo pouches, backpacks, shovels. What does a mobile headquarters actually look like? You know, sometimes just watching movies and assuming they're getting it right. And that's when I went down to the World War II Museum down in New Orleans and managed to get in contact with a curator there by the name of Tony, and she took me behind the scenes, and I told her I was there for visual research, She showed me a lot of the stuff they had in vaults and everything else, which was really inspiring. And she offered, like, hey, if you ever are looking for something, you can't seem to find it, contact me. I'll go take some photos of it and then send you back an email. So I've just by putting it out there, I've gotten so much response to the story that I didn't expect to have. This was something I was kind of worried about. Like, I am Asian American, but I'm Chinese American, right? So the just Japanese American story is, I part of me feels like it's not mine to tell, but at the same time, mm-hmm. I can look at it and be like, well, I should be the one to kind of help tell it as someone who Chinese and Japanese, like, historically, right, don't quite get along, but like this is American story, Asian Americans.
Yeah.
So it was.
It seems like a lot of the times that the problem with that is that the story's not being treated with the respect it deserves.
Yeah.
And so, man, it sure feels like you're giving everything to this story. I mean, and it shows from the people who are excited about what you're doing and your and your project.
I will say, you know, I travel to a lot of conventions and shows, and the first time, and it wasn't the only time, that tears were shed at my table. I'm talking to them about it or whatever else. Maybe they had a personal connection, or sometimes it's not even. And there are tears. The person across from me is listening to the story, and just like I see a tear, their eyes water up, and then I start watering up, and it's just like a horrible sobbing moment in the middle of a happy convention. But that's also, as you say, just like motivation for me to kind of do the best I can, if I can, you know, just get it in front of people and get that same emotional content, then I think I've done my job.
Right. Yeah. That's amazing. Like I said, I don't think that, well, in the story, like, these people want to tell this story. So it's like, oh, please, someone tell the story. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like that's why we do this as a job. That's why we curate these things. It's why we're hanging on to these things, is so that the story can get told.
Right. And that's, you know, and that's part of the history, is like, in order to pass along and share the history, we need to create the story so that people can share that stuff sometimes. Right. Because it's too... Unfortunately, it's too monotonous or boring or not exciting to just talk about the actual encyclopedia article, right? Mm-hmm. The facts and statistics don't do it. But if you create a story through it, people will remember that story. People will tell parts of that story. People will share that a little bit more. And that is my goal as well. There have been, historical comics that have been done. On many important things, and I've used them as part of the research as well. And sometimes it feels like it's just an illustrated encyclopedia article, right? And mm-hmm. I'm just like, that's definitely not what I want to try to achieve with it. It'd be the easier way to do it, but it's mm-hmm. not the goal with that.
So. Right. Yeah. No. An illustrated. That's a good point. So that's what I was going to ask you, is like, what makes you feel like the comic medium is the best way to tell the story?
That's a good one. I thought about this one too. One of the great things I love about comics is that, unlike books, where you know you read it all, it's an effort to read it, and it's all in your imagination. That's great. Not everyone has that super visual imagination that you need sometimes to like really capture it all, right? And unlike a movie, where it just kind of gives you, and you're a very passive third person, you're just receiving it all, right? Mm-hmm. But you get those emotional moments that you can partake in because we're visual creatures. I think comics can hit that sort of nice middle ground. You have you have the words to really explain things out when you need to, and you can elicit some of those emotions. You know, I'm sure you and I can go back on just key moments in our own personal history with comics where you're like, man, that scene, like it hit, like those words. Mm-hmm. And when this superhero, you know, XYZ, you know, like you remember the visuals as well as the words. And I think that's part of it with comics, right? You force the person, you give them a little bit of a visual to latch onto, but you also force them to imagine in between the panels, right? You give them before and give them after, and they have to put themselves within that scene. So it's an active, and sometimes they don't realize it, right? It's a certain mm-hmm. active participation they have in that story, if the story can grab you, or if the images can hold on to you, right?
Right. Well, and you're doing your preferred medium is watercolors. Yes. And gouache, and I'm sure other mixed media that you put in there, because it probably goes in digitally at some point, scan it, and then fix it up with Photoshop and stuff. That's fine.
Inks and stuff like that sometimes.
Yeah. So one of the properties that I found of your comic here is that, and I think it works really well for this story, is the watercolors look like a recalled memory. You know what I mean? Where it looks like something where it's because it's not fully formed, right? That's watercolor. Yeah. It is impressions of things. It's colors and emotions and sometimes parts of faces or parts of backgrounds and stuff like that. So
you have the luxury with watercolor. It's an amazing medium because you can be a little amorphous with it, and mm-hmm. you can be unfinished with it, and people will still accept it. Right, there's like, oh, mm-hmm. I, you know, the drips, the drabs, the partially finished faces, and it's like, oh, it's unfinished, but it's finished, right? Mm-hmm. Versus something that is purely digital or oils or something like that. There's a point where you have to get to sometimes with the other mediums where like, okay, this is where the expectation of it being finished is going to look like, but with watercolor, mm-hmm. sometimes you really get away if you're getting an emotional thing, just focus on the eyes and just have it dripped, you know, put some textures in it, let the watercolor do its thing, and it can be a complete piece because the viewer gets a chance to kind of finish it. And people seem to inherently know, as best way I can explain, just people seem to inherently know that you're trying to control water with that medium. And so they just kind of immediately give it a pass on certain things like, oh, it's not exact or it's not perfect. Oh, that's okay. It's water. It's watercolor, versus if you just try to translate that to it's something digital, right? People will understand like, oh, well, you should have all the tools that you need to control every single pixel to get it exact and to get it correct and to get it quote unquote right, right? Mm-hmm. Those things will stand out a little bit more in those other mediums.
So right now, people can read the most of the 442nd Lost Battalion on webtoons.com. Yep. And I believe there's going to be more available next month.
Yes. Yes. So I have a bunch of episodes that'll be released in rapid succession that haven't been released yet in May. May is Asian American History Month. So that'll be a perfect time kind of share more of the story and get it out there. Currently, I got my first sponsor, a video game called World of Warships. Mm-hmm. And so right now, anyone who plays World of Warships can download it through them. So they kind of have a priority at some of this mm-hmm. for being the sponsor for March and April. But come May, everything that they was available through them is going to be available to the public. So that's when that's all going to come out.
Right. And are there plans for a print edition?
Yes. There is going to be plans for a print edition. I am hoping that I will have, I have a stack of artwork, you know, like 2 inches thick right now. I'm hoping to be assembling that near the end of this year. The way I have painted and structured everything is sort of without panels. So if there's a scene or there's a panel, I'll just paint it and I won't actually paint in the panels. And for the webcomic, I digitally laid it out. So I create the panels and shove the artwork into the panels, the digital panels, and shove the artwork, traditional artwork in. And so when I go to a print, I have that all the same artwork, but I'll have to lay it out a little differently. So it'll be a different experience. I don't want to just take, they're two different mediums, right? The digital scrollable pages versus, you know, the actual flip pages where you want to like time, you know, when someone flips the page and like leave little cliffhangers at the end of, you know, the bottoms of the pages and stuff like that.
Nice. What was the most memorable thing that you've kind of uncovered in your research?
There's some really soft stories, I guess, and realizations. One of the stories I tell from time to time is I was at the Japanese American Cultural Museum, and they were showing me artifacts from the internment camps. And there was someone had carved into a river rock, those smooth, flat rocks, they carved a poem into it. And I can't read Japanese, but I can tell that it was also dated. I could recognize the numbers, and he had carved in his name, and it was just a haiku, I'm guessing, or some sort of Japanese poem about that he was a person that was alive, that he was here as sort of a memento that he was at this camp. And it was sort of a stone that commemorated that. And it only then did it actually hit me that in those moments, they did not have the luxury of knowing what would happen. We as people in the future, so to speak, looking backwards, can look at it and be like, oh, they were here for a year, they were here for 2 years, 4 years, this is what happened. And in that moment, I was like, oh, they had no idea how long they were going to be there. They had no idea when World War II was going to end. And that kind of changed my perspective a little bit in terms of just thinking about the actual historical events. Wasn't just like, oh, from this event, then this event, then this event, you know, sort of the academic version of history, right? You're just like, oh, I'm memorizing these events. That's when they happen. That's the order and that's that. And this kind of humanized it for me. And it was like, I need to capture that perspective of just the unknown of what would happen, right? So that was one. It was a really kind of small thing, but it did open my eyes. On sort of a more of a crazier story, I guess, was, well, there's a story where the 442nd was tasked to take out a stronghold. A fortification that was on top of a hill, right? This German fortification had been there for a while, so they had all their machine guns in the perfect places. There was no blind spots and everything else, but the one unique part about this was that it was at the top of a sort of a ridge, a cliff, right? And so it really just only needed to defend three sides, because the backside was just this cliff and, you know, what's going to come up from behind them when you have that? Except they didn't realize the sort of they didn't realize the chutzpah, if you will, and the how that the Japanese Americans, the 442nd, would actually use that to their advantage. One of the soldiers realized that it was going to be a it was going to be a relative suicide mission. They were going to lose a lot of men if they attacked it as the army expected them to do head on. Mm-hmm. And so some of the soldiers realized that it was going to be a new moon the next night. And it would be really dark. And so they all decided, like, well, might as well try to climb up this cliff. It would end up being about a 6 to 8 hour climb up that back wall. They started around like 10 p.m. when it was dark. Full gear, right? You got to bring your guns, your ammo, your packs. It's dark. The veterans that spoke of it could only see the guy in front of them, the guy behind them maybe. And they knew they had to be extremely quiet throughout this whole thing, right? So, you know, imagine all of those things already is going to make it an extremely difficult sort of exercise to mm-hmm. accomplish. But they also knew that it was dangerous and that there was a good chance that some of them might not make the climb. And so they all had to agree that even if they fell, they would not make a sound. Hmm. And so some of the veterans that speak of it, of that particular events, they'll say, yeah, we're climbing. It's quiet, just the sounds of the countryside. And every once in a while, there'd be a thump on the ground before them, below them. And a soldier had slipped, missed a hold, a foothold, a handhold, and didn't say a word. The people next to him didn't shout out and scream out like, ah! Mm-hmm. And they just hit the ground hundreds and hundreds of feet below. The 442nd made it to the top of the cliff by dawn, and they had control of that fortification within the hour.
That's amazing. Yeah.
So those are some things. And every medal, right, there's a story. And sometimes you can't figure out how to put the story in place. There's stories mm-hmm. of scouts that have gone behind enemy lines and come back with like 8 or 9 or 10 prisoners, German prisoners. You're like a single scout, right? You're just mm-hmm. like, how did you come back and sneak back 8 or 9 German soldiers single-handedly, literally single-handedly? I don't know. But
right.
those are the bullet points for every medal. They have to say why they got that medal. So there's 18,000 stories.
So. Wow. That sounds like that's a television show I would watch, certainly, you know, and learn from. And
absolutely.
Series, something like that, that incorporates a bunch of those stories. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, maybe when your Netflix deal comes through, you can remember. Remember your friends from Facebook.
Yeah. Like, especially the ones that I've been friends with for like 10 years before.
Yeah.
Before the glory, right?
Yeah, beforehand. Yeah. So we were, I did want to talk to you a little bit because I love talking about, so first off, before we leave that very, very inspiring book, I recommend everybody go and check this out. Even if you're not into the battleship, what's the game called again?
It's called Warships.
World of
Warships.
Yes, yes. Even like, go sign up for an account so that you can read the comic.
It's a free game.
Oh, it's free. Yeah, so there you go. And then you get access to the whole comic, and check that out. And then obviously, make sure that you stay in touch with Tony Ford, like, so that you can find out when it comes out for print. But shifting gears just a little bit from the very serious subject and awesome book and historical subject that I feel wonderfully educated and made more aware of now, and that I am 100% going to go look more into. Mm-hmm. But I like talking about conventions as well. Yeah. And you are such a convention veteran. I just have to talk to you about a few things. Yeah. First of all, on the list is our good friends at the Reed Pop, Emerald City Comic Con, which we both attended this last one mm-hmm. at the new convention center.
Yes.
That they have there, the brand new convention center. So before anything else, first impressions, what did you think?
In the previous, the old convention center, you know, Seattle's hilly, so it was like four floors vertically. It's like a vertical convention center. And they had the artists always on the topmost. You got to take a skyrocket of a escalator, the longest escalator I think I've actually seen, and it goes up to like the sixth floor. And we're up in this like attic of the old one. This one was, as from the artist's perspective at least, like we're on like the main floor. There's a huge window. We get natural lighting. That kind of came in. I feel like we had sort of, it was nice to have like prime position and not to have an artist alley skewed away somewhere. I think we were very easy to access this year for it. So I liked it. I know some of the vendors who kind of got relegated to like more of a basement floor. They had some nice words to say, but as an artist, I thought it was great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, as a fan, it was nice. It was, I only went on Saturday, which was felt like a huge mistake. So busy, but it was busy, like hugely busy.
It was.
A couple of the artists and vendors that I talked to said it's the best show that they've had in years.
Yeah,
I mean, counting the pandemic, but even previous to the pandemic, like it was a banner year.
Yeah, no, it felt like coming out of the pandemic, there were definitely shows that were like, okay, they're just trying to get back into it. The area is recovering, or people are haven't fully gotten out of it yet. But this one felt like old times. It definitely felt like a good busy show. Like my table mate Dan Govar, we usually table next to each other. At the end of Saturday, I kind of look over to him and he's like, I'm like, I don't think I've stopped talking all day. And he was like, yeah, you've been talking all day. I'm like, I don't want to talk anymore. Like, I'm done. It was just constant flow of people. It's been a while.
Nice. Do you get what? So you have like you have your originals there, yes. Like your beautiful watercolors, yes. that you have there. Do you sell prints? And,
yeah. So
and,
I have sort of I call it my triumvirate of products. I have prints. I have original art that's pre-made and pre-done. And then I have, I take on commissions at the show, right? So those are basically my three categories of sales, if you will. And usually if two of them do well and sell well, then it's usually a pretty good show. And there's a few shows where everything will go. And, you know, I got commissions, original art will sell, people buy my prints and, that's what it was like this year at Seattle. So it was a really good show.
Yeah. What did the best out of the mix?
Seattle is interesting because, I get a lot of, is a little bit more anime. So a lot of my Ghibli stuff will be pretty popular. There are actually a few. What's nice about Seattle is that quite often my non-comic book or non-pop culture art will actually sell well. I have a few like landscapes that I've done or pieces that are just my own random thoughts. I'll shove them in as original art pieces and they will sell there. I did a piece for Chinese New Year. It's Year of the Rabbit. So I did a couple, you know, a couple rabbits. And that sold, right? And like, hey, I sold rabbits at a Comic-Con. Like, all right. But yeah, like there's a nice art vibe in the city of Seattle that like, you know, they're not just coming by and looking for a Nightcrawler or a, you know, Spider-Man or X, Y, or Z.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's pretty great. Did I see on your, are you going too soon or have you recently been in at the UK?
Yeah. Yes.
Comic-Con?
So last year I did 23 shows and I also went out to four different countries. So London is a easy one for me to do. It was one of my first international shows before the pandemic. And so I kind of enjoy, you know, visiting there. And I will be back there again this May, at the end of May, for MCM Comic-Con. London has two conventions a year, one in the spring and one in the fall, and they're a big enough city that they can handle it. I've only ever seen London in the fall, so this may be my first time going to London in the spring, summer, so we'll see how that goes.
That's awesome. Yeah. You'll have to report back to us what moves over there.
I mean, it's a good show. It's a good show.
Nice. So also, one thing I was going to ask about while I was at your table, you had a couple of pieces that were of the Hulk.
Yes.
And you had you got him signed by Mark Ruffalo.
Yeah.
Yeah. What'd you do with those guys?
So the nice thing that Reed Pop does, right, at most of their shows is they do a charity auction for St. Jude's Children's Hospital, which is a great foundation. Even as a charity, a lot of their donations go directly to their causes. And I've been any of their shows where I am at, or even the ones I'm not at, I will donate a piece to that auction. This year, they kind of contact me and say, hey, Mark Ruffalo is going to be here. Can you do a Hulk? We'll have him sign it and we'll do it for the charity auction. Because sometimes I ask them, like, oh, what do you want to do? What do you think will sell? And so I painted two Hulks and they were able to get one signed for myself.
Nice.
So one of them I have is, you know, my own little Mark Ruffalo signature with on my art, and then the other one sold for about $900, I believe, for charity, which was one of the top handful of sales at the charity auction. So always excited about that. And I did one of Captain America for the C2E2 one that was signed by Chris Evans. And that one,
nice.
That one also sold for about close to the same.
That's not surprised at the price, because they were gorgeous. I got to see those in person.
Oh, thank you.
And yeah, of course. No, they were super fun. And what a fun way to have a piece like that go in an auction. That's really cool.
Yeah. No, it's I generally try to, if there's an opportunity to do that, and you know, it's one of the things I think that art is good at, is to either, you know, in the case of my comic and things like that, to help promote an idea or a concept or share some of that, or also to raise awareness for certain things, whether it's just a fun event like a charity auction or something like that.
Yeah, that is really cool. So I did want to ask you about your watercolors.
Sure.
It's magic as far as I'm concerned. Like I do some art, you know, do some self-published comics here and stuff like that. Try to work with Copics and, you know, like try all the different mediums and stuff. And, watercolor, man, that is just one that is rough it is so unforgiving at first. You know what I mean? Like it is, so how did you get like started into like that watercolors, and how come that one kind of ended up being the one that stuck with you?
So I share your sentiment in terms of like, you know, magic and watercolor kind of a thing, because before I picked it up, or even before I gained some experience with it, I was just a black and white artist, pen and ink, pencils. Like if you contacted me, if you talked to me before, I started painting, I would have told you that, oh, I'm just one of those artists that sees the world in black and white and gray. Right. Like that's it. Mm-hmm. Like I can't. Colors were mystical. I'm right there with you. And then it was one particular year, is personally, that year was filled with a lot of trials and tribulations on a personal level. And I kind of threw myself into art again with a different perspective. It was kind of my own version of art therapy, right? I was like, I've been so afraid of colors. You know, I dabbled in some digital colors here and there, and I know my way around Photoshop, but it was amateur. And I tried everything. I remember trying oil painting. I remember trying to figure out acrylics, Copics, digital, color pencil. And I actually owe sort of my initiation into watercolors. There's an artist named Ben Temple Smith, who's a good friend of mine.
Yeah.
And he dabbles in watercolor as well. And I remember seeing him at a show. We were kind of friends. I don't think I had done a show then yet. But I remember seeing him paint with wine, right? He was like painting with wine and then, you know, dabbling some watercolors into the piece. And I was like, oh, watercolors. Like, it's such a first grade kindergarten sort of medium in a certain way, right? And I was like, oh, let me give that a shot. And the best way I can sort of describe that initial part of the journey was that the frustrations that watercolor just gave me just enough frustration that I would want, I would think that, I can figure this out. I can get this. It should be simple, right? The other stuff I had, it gave me excuses for it, right? I was like, oh, Copics, I can't get the blends because I need to buy all the markers for that. Or oils, I was like, oh, I have to get canvases and I probably need gesso. I just probably don't have enough of the tools to like figure this out. But watercolor was, it's a little bit of paint, a little bit of water and a paintbrush and paper. Like that's it. There's no other excuses other than, you know, water. So it just gave me enough encouragement to kind of keep on going and not give up. And I think that was enough for me to like, okay, well, maybe I'll just stick with this for a little while. And yeah, that's my early watercolors it wasn't an instantaneous like, oh, this clicks, this makes sense. The early watercolors were several shades of atrocious.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
No, they're fantastic. Yeah, Ben Temple Smith, love his stuff. He's amazing with anything he ever draws with. It's ridiculous. Like he does. I got a sketch from him a few years ago at a local shop here, Black Cat Comics. Shout out to Greg. He did like I asked him for a Slender Man. My kids were very into Slender Man, like lots of kids at the time. And so I said, can you do a Slender Man? And he did it with like a Bic pen on the back of a backer board.
Yeah.
And it was so frightening. My kids couldn't have it on the wall. I pinned it in their room and I said, here's what you asked for. And they were like, can it go away?
He is one of those like creatives that it doesn't matter if you put some sort of tool in his hand that he's never used before, he will figure out a way to do something with it and it'll be really cool. I've seen him just say like, oh, what's that weird ink acrylic thing? Okay, let me try it. Like, shit, did something amazing.
Yeah, 100%. The other two, like your watercolors, just S-tier watercolors that I always see when I'm at conventions and like through my Facebook feed and whatnot. Other two that I really like their watercolors from is J.K. Woodward.
Yes,
does a lot of work for. Sat next to him at a convention one time. Nicest guy in the world.
And the pages are so huge.
Yes. I've got one on my wall here. And it's huge, but had to find a frame for it.
Yeah.
But also Mark Sparacio does a lot of really cool stuff. He does a wet on dry.
Oh, okay.
And so does a lot of stuff for Vampirella and whatnot.
Okay.
But
I
love that. So is that was watercolor and gouache what you used to teach?
No, honestly.
Okay.
I started off teaching design.
Right? Okay.
So like Photoshop and design and web design and some of that stuff. And my agreement with the school eventually was like, hey, I don't know if you know this, but because I was into like web technologies before this new life that I have. I was like, I know you kind of have me here to kind of teach design and this, but I can also do this stuff. And they started just tossing me some random courses whenever there wasn't a instructor or the instructor wanted to take a break from a course. So I taught like studio art courses. They gave me the storyboarding classes, which was really nice of them. I never was actually able to teach the watercolor course because it was the professors for that were just, they had it on lockdown.
Gotcha.
You know, so unfortunately I was never do that, but the studio art courses that I taught, we were able to like touch on a variety of different mediums and things like that. So I did teach a little bit of it in those formats.
Gotcha. Yeah. So are most of the commissions and stuff, so the commissions that you get from people, you take them and you can do them at the show.
Yes.
What's like the weirdest commission thing that you get that you've either been asked for and turned down, or that you were like, oh, I could do that, and then went with it?
The ones I
generally, or interesting. It doesn't have to be weird. Just what memorable? How's that?
Yeah, there is one where I had to create the Little Mermaid, right? Which is cool. Little Mermaid, sure. And watercolor. That's great. But the twist on it was Carnage.
Cool.
The wife or the fiance, her favorite Disney character was a Little Mermaid, and obviously his was Carnage, and they wanted they asked me to do a mashup of the two. So it was like a Carnage redhead Ariel.
That sounds rad. That sounds amazing. Yeah.
So I remember that one. That one's a very interesting mashup. Just Disney and then, you know, Carnage.
Now also Disney.
Yeah. That one also Disney.
Yeah.
So the ones I don't do at shows are personal portraits. You know, it's one thing to ask for Michael Keaton Batman or something like that, right? I can do that. But when it gets a little personal, sometimes I avoid those. And if you really want it, get me outside the convention. But those are generally ones that I kind of save for personal when. Mm-hmm. Gifts and things like that, if I choose to do it. I'm trying to think of some other interesting ones. Usually it's just combinations of, mm-hmm. of like mashups of characters.
Is there any that you're like, I'm not going to do another Venom, or like what, not to pick on any particular character, but is there anybody that you're just like, oh, good.
There are definitely ones that I choose. I will let them know that there are better artists for if they really want that. You know, I'm not known for my voluptuous women, right? And those kind of pieces of art. And occasionally they'll come to me and I'm like, I will do it, but it'll be in sort of my style and my approach. I'm, you know,
sure.
I know what you're looking for, but unfortunately, not something. So I'll have a few things like that, some boundaries.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just wondering.
Or like
I don't know.
Anime. Like I'll do anime, but I'm always like, I will do that anime character in sort of my interpretation of that anime character. I'm not going to do it in that style.
Right? Sure.
Because that, you know, again, I can, but just because I can doesn't mean that, you know, I got to think about my own brand as well, which is an interesting thing. Like, right. Like,
yeah.
If I'm always copying other styles, you know, which you do as an artist, you learn by absorbing other people's styles. You eventually want to focus on your own interpretations.
Oh, sure. Yeah, no. Well, I mean, you have a unique style. You can tell your brand, and I feel like that's, you can tell if you look, I feel like if you look back at your, you would see like that this is what's emerged, and hopefully people that are coming to commission you want your style, right? They look at your artwork and they say, well, I that's exactly what I want, is I want a Dr. Doom that looks like you did it. I could get one from someone else that looks like it was.
Every once in a while there'll be some like, can you do it like this artist? I'm like, and sometimes they're doing it because that artist is so, unless it's that artist is, to get something from that artist is so difficult because they either don't do shows or they're just way too expensive. And I get it. But unless that artist is like no longer around, or you want an homage to a piece, right. Or an older cover or something like that. You know, if you're looking at Silver Age, like, hey, you know, do this classic Superman cover. Can you do your version of that? Like, okay. Yeah. Hmm. Not a problem. You know, Superman with the car and stuff like that can do that. But if it's something like, last year Jim Lee did this cover, can you do it just like that? Well, like,
I was going to say, so the next time I see you,
from it?
Next time I see you at the show, I'm going to be like, all right, I want a Spider-Man, but I want it to look like Umberto Ramos did it.
Yeah, there you go.
And would you kindly sign it, Umberto Ramos? Because that's how I'm going to submit it to CGC.
Right.
And it's just going to be between us. And then we've got this nice racket going on eBay. Mm-hmm. No, I can totally understand. I get exactly where you're coming from. And that's sometimes like conventions are always super fun, but it's a mix of people, right? So you'll get like this set of people who just kind of don't understand what's going on. Yeah. And maybe they're feeling out like what they're getting into and stuff like that. And
I thought of another interesting commission I got one time. They asked me for Saturn Girl. Right.
Except okay.
They showed me a copy of like an old like 70s, a comic from the 70s, like really classic artwork and stuff like that. And they're like, oh, can you do like this version of her, like from like the 60s, 70s with like, you know, the time period hairstyle or stuff like that. I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah, that's not a problem. And then I'm sketching it out and they're like, oh, do you think you can put like fishnet stockings on her or something else like that? I'm like, sure, I guess. And like, and slowly they started like tacking on and changing things. Like, can you make her costume leather instead of like the, I'm like, can you have her holding a whip? I'm like, if you just wanted a dominatrix in like that 60s, 50s style, like, well, you could just ask for that.
That's pretty great.
Yeah, they just slowly tweaked as I was doing it in front of them.
The way you were explaining it and the things he was adding on, I was like, okay, it's never going to be that they're like, hey, can you add her like a robot arm or something? Or she's got like a shopping cart. You know, it's always, it's like, can it be this?
Yeah.
Are there other requests?
Down that other road, or you're just like,
how far are we driving down this road, friend?
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
Because I'm on the next off ramp here. Is what we're going to be talking about on this one. Running a family friendly show here.
Right. Exactly.
But that's hilarious. Yeah. I love that sort of stuff.
That was another memorable one.
Nice. So, what's your you go to a ton of conventions and what is like, what's your favorite thing about like being at conventions and like, what's the worst thing that you could just do away with? You had a magic wand and it would never happen or never be at a convention again.
Yeah.
You could have it. What are those two things?
Okay. First there's two things that I really enjoy. One is, you know, the fans, the people come see you, whether the differentiation between like fans and like friends on that level after they come and see you out and they're like you're talking to them and everything else, there's a relationship all of a sudden that's built up, like it's really cool, and I enjoy that. And also it helps to get feedback and that excitement about your artwork that you don't get no matter how many likes you have on an Instagram post or on a Facebook post, right? And that was one of the things I definitely missed after 2 years away at a pandemic, you know, was just people coming by and you can see an expression when they look at your artwork or like, oh, I love what you did with this piece or this character or whatever else. And that feedback, you know, is motivating and inspiring, I think, on many levels, and sometimes is all the fuel you need to kind of keep going, like, yeah, I made the right choice in life.
Nice.
Along with that are sort of your compatriots, right? Are artist friends and stuff like that. Like, I'm from a big city. I have a couple friends who are artists around here. But at the same time, there's that struggle of a convention artist. There's the stories that you can share and for comic artists and things like that. That you're like, oh yeah, I understand you and I get you, and there's that part of it. Unfortunately, even though I have, like, it's great to see and meet up with all my you know, sort of convention artist friends and stuff like that, the part that's really tough sometimes is that the shows get so busy that you don't get to hang out with them. You just kind of get to, like, you know, see them and you talk for about 5-10 minutes, and you know that they have to work and you got to go back to your table and work. And even afterwards, everyone's trying to like find time to like catch up or grab a beer or get dinner or something like that. But then you have commissions to work on and everything else. So it's that part of it is tough, because you only get to see some of these, some of my friends every couple months. Sometimes they don't go to all the shows. Right. And that camaraderie, that friend, those friendships that you make along the way, of traveling to shows and making it to shows is good fuel for the soul as much as the fans are. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish there was a way to balance that a little bit more, at a show. I guess sometimes as well, it's a double-edged sword. You know, taking on all these commissions, there are a lot of late nights,
sure, yeah.
Early mornings, you know, it's a 10 to 7 show for the fans, but it's a 8 to 8 show for me. Right. I get there at 8:30, you know, hour and a half before everyone, just to make sure everything's are set up, gets a little bit of free time to work on some commissions. And then after it closes, it takes me about a half hour to an hour to kind of, you know, wind things down. Then you're trying to get dinner and everything else. And then you're doing it again for the next two or three days. So that grind of it is tough, especially last year when I did like 23 shows. That was inhuman, just from my perspective. I just couldn't say no to a lot of the guest opportunities that were kind of coming my way.
Right. That's pretty great.
Yeah. But it's kind of, you know, it's a welcomed, it's the trials and tribulations are welcome, because everything else makes it worth it.
That's pretty great. I love those answers. So we're at the top of the hour here. So, one last question here, because you are, in Chicago.
Yes.
Cubs or White Sox, man?
Good question. It has to be Cubs.
Because, oh my gosh.
Because.
Yes.
I have a good story for this.
Okay.
My great grandmother and great grandfather were the first to come over in Chicago. My great grandfather came in like the 20s. He set up one of the first Chinese restaurants in downtown Chicago.
Okay.
My great grandmother couldn't speak a word, a lick of English. Right. Even I knew her a little bit when I was a really, really young Tony Moy. But the one, she couldn't really watch TV, but the one thing she figured out how to watch was baseball, specifically the Cubs. She just knew them by the numbers. And because baseball at the time was just like they would show the numbers on the bottom and the stats, she just learned what that meant. And she would, I remember growing up, and she'd be like, oh, did the Cubs win today? Or did the Cubs do this? Or she'd be watching a Cubs game, and that was the only thing on TV that she would, that was her excitement. So by virtue of family history, it kind of has to be Cubs. Even though in general, I am a Chicago fan. I will root for anything Chicago, but... But Cubs has a special place in my heart.
That's a great story. I love that. You were going to say White Sox, and I was going to end the interview. I'm just kidding. When I was a kid, I was a big Cubs fan. Yeah. Andre Dawson, the Hawk, was always my favorite player.
Yes. Yes.
And
the
I have
Boston,
probably.
Yep.
Yep. Oh yeah, I've got
Standard.
A. Yep, I've got a Mark Grace signed ball in the other room. An Andre Dawson one, of course, as well. I got to meet him in person once.
Nice.
I've even got a Jerome Walton one. Like, you can tell what years of the Cubs I was a fan of. They would play, I had cable, and they would play on WGN Chicago.
Yes.
And so it was the team I could watch almost every game. So of course I was going to be a fan.
Yeah. There are a lot of Cubs fans all over the country. It's amazing.
Yeah. So, but no, that's pretty great. I love that. So, Tony, thank you so much for taking the time today. I really appreciate this. It was great to continue our conversation from starting to finally meet you in person up at Emerald City.
Of course, yeah, it was great.
Your artwork is wonderful. I'm always in awe of it every time that one comes through my feed. I just love it. And this this work that you're doing with the 442nd Regiment story is important, and thank you for doing it and teaching us all that important story about American history, and keep it up. I'm looking forward to supporting the digital version, getting a print version to proudly put next to my George Takei book on the shelf, as next to my comic book of the Constitution and all of these important historical comics that I have up here. It's great work. And so for the last word here, can you tell everybody where they can connect with you and follow your work and make sure that they have this on their radar so that they can keep updated?
Yeah. Best place to go is Instagram, Tony_Moy. My profile there has a link to pretty much everything that I'm on, from TikTok to YouTubes and things like that. You can also go to the442nd.com. That's either the numbers 442nd.com or number 440 and then 2 and whichever version. I bought a whole bunch of domains. I realized that spelling it and saying it were going to be a difficult to decipher through. So I bought a whole bunch of them.
Nice.
But the 442nd.com has information about where to read it, some artwork, and some of the stories behind it. As well as I stream on Twitch, Tony_Moy, and on YouTube under the same name. You can look up Paint Bros as well, which is a YouTube channel that I do with my friend Dan Govar. It's like dueling pianos with watercolor.
Nice. So,
yeah.
And check your local Comic-Con. There's a chance that Tony's going to be there also.
I will be in Vegas next weekend, end of April.
I will be there as well.
Oh, I'll see you there.
I'll come flip over your table.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, all this great artwork. And throw it on the floor.
MCM in London, Heroes Con in Charlotte, Denver, Chicago Dragon Con, New York, a whole bunch of them. So
check your local listings there and mm-hmm. go and don't give them a hard time. Don't flip over the table. That would be just terrible. Yeah, buy something.
It's
that would be helpful. Yes, or so come say hi. That would be fine too. Yeah,
please do.
Follow. Awesome. Thank you so much, man. I really appreciate all your time. Thanks for being part of the Lane Urich Report today, which is featured on the World's Greatest Comic Book Podcast, which is the name of the show, and Opinions Vary. You can find at greatestcomicbookpodcast.com. Awesome. Thank you so much, everybody. And thank you, Tony. Have a great evening.
Thank you. Have a great time.